From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Let's dig right into the news of the day. Robert Mueller's first public statements about his two-year-long Russia investigation, announcing he's closing his office, resigning, his report complete, reiterating that he did not clear the president of obstruction because, as he said, if we had confidence he did not obstruct, we would have said so. We could not. Indicating his hands were tied by Justice Department guidelines that say a sitting president cannot be indicted.
So that was Justice Department policy. Those were the principles under which we operated. And from them, we concluded that we would not reach a determination one way or the other about whether the president committed a crime.
Many reading into that statement that Mueller is sending a message to Congress that the ball is now in their court. So let's bring in our political strategist, Jamal Simmons, Democratic strategist. Hi, Jamal.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. And Matt Mikowiak, Republican strategist. Hi, Matt.
Hey there.
So let's get both of your takes on what Mueller said today. Jamal, starting with you, because a lot of people, as I said, are saying this is Mueller saying to Congress, it's up to you. I couldn't say whether or not the president should be indicted, but you can make a move forward and maybe bring a charge. So what should Democrats do now?
Well, Democrats should take this very seriously and begin having hearings, perhaps even open an impeachment inquiry to take a look at it. Justin Amash, the Republican congressman from Grand Rapids, Michigan, which I'm from Michigan, and I got to tell you, Grand Rapids is the heart of the conservative movement in Michigan, home to the DeVos family, which has given probably about, I think, Betsy DeVos said $200 million in contributions to Republicans, that Justin Amash has come out and said that this is something that we need to inquire about because it's grave and it's serious and it's not something to be taken lightly. The president of the United States, one, reacted very badly when he was approached and helped by Russian actors, and two, tried to obstruct justice when people began to look into that question. And the country needs to take this very seriously and decide whether or not we think the president of the United States should be overseen by Congress, or does he get to be, you know, kind of a sovereign power that can do whatever he wants.
And Matt, how did you see what we saw today from Robert Mueller?
Yeah, I mean, I tweeted before the statement began that I thought he was giving the statement because he was going to explain why he would not be testifying, and that turned out to be the case. Mm. To me, I really only saw two takeaways. One, he's not going to testify, at least not voluntarily. I imagine Democrats on the House side will subpoena him. Be interesting to see whether he just decides to appear or whether he tries to fight the subpoena. And then second, I think, to the broader point, I think this does put additional pressure on the House Democratic leadership to, sort of fish or cut bait on the impeachment question. They've been stymied up to this point, really haven't gotten much new information, don't have the tax returns, haven't had access to witnesses, haven't really learned anything. In fact, I think as of today, not even one Democratic member of Congress has gone in to read the almost entirely unredacted version that's available to members of Congress. So this does put a lot of pressure on Speaker Pelosi. She's resisted, beginning impeachment proceedings, her presidential candidates, and increasingly the, dozens and dozens and dozens of members of Congress are pushing her in that direction. She's going to have to make a decision soon, and it's going to be a tough one.
Well, but Matt, does it put some pressure on Republicans? Jamal mentions Justin Amash. Yes, he is the only Republican in Congress to accuse President Trump of impeachable conduct. But there was that, meeting with voters he had last night in Michigan. Yes, there was some criticism from some of them who said, you should not be doing this. But mostly standing ovations, applause from people like this man. Let's listen.
First, I want to salute your courage.
And so he went on to say, how can we, change the situation we're in right now? But saluting that Republican for calling for impeachment proceedings, doesn't this, with Mueller coming out and saying, we feel there were incidents that could be, incidents of obstruction, we could not clear the president. We did not clear the president. Isn't there some pressure there?
I really don't think so. I mean, I think if there was pressure there, you'd have additional Republicans stepping forward. Amash is really on an island. He's by himself. I would wager right now he will not be renominated to Congress. In fact, may not even seek reelection at this point. So, I don't know that one town hall in one congressional district with one member of Congress that has a view tells us anything. I think if there really was that kind of groundswell of opinion, I think the speaker would be moving in that direction. The reason she hasn't moved towards impeachment is that she realizes it's a political loser. And so she's now caught between, the 31 Democratic members of Congress who are running for re-election from Trump districts and her Democratic base. And so, I'll be happy to give Amash some credit. Going against the president of your own party, doing it on what appears to be a fairly principled basis, I strongly disagree with his conclusion. But he's obviously put himself out there. I think it's politically unwise, and I think it's not going anywhere.
Well, Jamal, I just want to ask you, are Democrats in a squeeze here now? Because you know Nancy Pelosi does not want the impeachment inquiry going into an election. And it feels as if this Republican Robert Mueller, it pretty much said today to Democrats, this is your job to do what I could not do.
Democrats are in a squeeze, but I don't want to let Republicans off the hook too fast. If you read the report, the Mueller report, I both read it and listened to the Washington Post audiobook, because that's how much of a nerd I am.
My Uber driver was listening to the Washington Post audiobook, too, all night
it's
long.
It's fascinating. I got to tell you, I don't want to promo the Washington Post too much, but it is a fascinating, dramatic read. And I got to tell you, it's not even close. It's not even close that there was obstruction of justice. The president of the United States asked his White House counsel to go fire the special counsel to get it in the way. The White House counsel refused to do it and was prepared to resign. The president of the United States then asked the White House counsel to come up with a false document when he was asked to say that the president didn't actually ask him to fire Robert Mueller. Like there are instance after instance that this report goes into that says that the president tried to obstruct justice. The question for Republicans is, what side of history does the Republican Party want to be on? And even if you decide that impeachment is not the answer, what is the answer for how we hold a president accountable when he has done something that clearly violates his oath of office?
Okay, I want to get to just a little bit of other news this week. And there was this moment that really struck a lot of people. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell reversing himself on his past stance of saying that you can't confirm a Supreme Court justice when there's a vacancy during a presidential election year. That was his stance famously in 2016 as he kept Merrick Garland from getting a hearing. And at an event last night, McConnell was asked what he would do this time around if there was a vacancy in 2020.
Oh, we'd fill it.
Matt, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think people are misremembering or misquoting what McConnell actually said. It wasn't simply that he wouldn't do it in a presidential leadership, that in a presidential election year. It was that it hadn't been done since the 1880s when a minority party controlled the Senate, different from the White House. That's the distinction. It's the distinction he made. I understand why people, particularly Democrats, would be frustrated by that. I imagine if the roles were reversed, I'd be frustrated. But this is why elections matter. He has control of the Senate. He has the ability to control that. Again, I don't think we're likely to see a death next year, although Ruth Bader Ginsburg is up there in years and you never know what can happen.
Well,
she's got her personal trainer. It looks like she's in pretty good
shape. She's very healthy. Yeah.
But Jamal, your thoughts when you hear the laughter.
The Republicans are making this up as they go. Mitch McConnell, it's clear that the one thing Republicans have proven they are committed to is being in power. When I worked for Senator Max Cleland and the Republicans used Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein to say that he refused to protect the country, a man who was sitting in a wheelchair who had lost three limbs after fighting in a war, combating against a man who had never served at all, it just shows you that they're not willing to stand by their principles if those principles are going to get in the way of power. And Mitch McConnell said that he wasn't going to do this in an election year. And now he's saying in an election year he would do it because why? It's all about power.
Yeah. Matt, what do you make of President Trump disagreeing pretty publicly with his now third national security advisor, John Bolton, on both the issue of North Korea and Iran? I would assume that Trump knew what he was getting into when he brought in this very, very, very hawkish national security advisor, and now he seems like he's not on the same page.
Yeah, look, I mean, President Trump, his positions evolve. They change quickly. And, Ambassador Bolton's positions don't change.
That's generous, right? Matt. I'm sorry. That's very generous.
Ambassador Bolton's been a hawk for, much of his adult life, much
of
his career.
Well, but how come President Trump didn't seem to know that?
Well, actually, this is one of the great misunderstandings about Trump. I think people think that they want that he wants to be surrounded by sycophants that only agree with him. First of all, it's impossible to agree with Trump 100% because he moves around a lot. But he actually really, truly does like to get positions from different sides. He likes to hear different opinions and then make a decision. And then he wants everyone to be on the team. So, look, I think, you know, at times he's been frustrated. Obviously, he wants to make more progress in North Korea than he's made. He's tried to maintain at least some relationship with the North Korean leader, not wanting to, you know, insult him while he's in the region. You know, we can second guess a lot of these decisions, a lot of these statements. I don't think Bolton's in any real danger. He's absolutely a foreign policy expert. The most impressive foreign policy speech I've ever seen in person is one he gave at a conference I was at in Denver 5 or 6 years ago. So, you know, is it possible he's stronger as a hawk than the president is? Yes. But ultimately, it's the president will make the decision on what the foreign policy is. And I don't think Ambassador Bolton's confused about that.
Jamal, you have 15 seconds.
Yeah, I interviewed General Jim Jones this morning for Hill TV for it's going to air tomorrow, and I asked him about this issue, and what he said to me is it also makes it uncomfortable for our allies because we are such a power that moves around so much.
Okay,
it's not healthy for our allies.
Got to leave it at that. Jamal Simmons, the Democratic strategist, Matt Mikowiak, the Republican, on another busy day. Thank you.
Thank you all.
Every day, more severe storms, tornadoes in the Midwest and the South. The National Weather Service is looking into reports of 20 tornadoes yesterday, including a huge one near Kansas City that caused a number of injuries. Let's check in, though, in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Parts of that city are underwater. NPR's Frank Morris is there. He joins us. And Frank, you told us the other day, this is the Arkansas River, right?
That's right. And I'm sitting right on the levee of the Arkansas River, which is running super high right now against these 70-year-old levees that have never been stressed like this. The river has been this high once before. The levees, the water's been up against these levees for days now, and it will be for days to come. And it's raining cats and dogs.
Well, first of all, be careful on the levee. But also the rain, that's also not helping as the river rises. Are there mandatory evacuations? What's going on?
There's a strong evacuation suggestion for parts of town protected by this levee. I'm sitting on this levee looking down into kind of a bowl between here and about a mile away. There's a highway that would just fill up if this levee breaches. And so some parts of town are inundated and people have evacuated there. They are not letting people drive through here. The police are stopping cars. Lots of businesses have already pulled out everything they can, and there's still people making. I just saw a truck driver drive through probably 3.5-4 feet of flood water to get his truck out of here.
Well, and of course,
and that was just about a minute ago.
And of course, we remember the advice is never drive into water in flooded areas because you just don't know.
His truck was already in the way. He had to wait out to get to it.
Oh,
and
then boy.
Drive across a fairly steep current to get his truck out of this rising water.
Well, thankfully,
The sheltered side of the levee.
Yeah, but thankfully, though, he didn't get swept away. Look, this levee, 70 years old, over 70 years old in many places. I mean, has there been talk of updating it, replacing it?
Well, yeah, there has been. They've been talking about this for years, and this levee is something that people here rely on, and they've been talked of extending it because the parts of town that are the worst flooded right now are the parts that are not protected by this levee system. It's a lot of money. It's hard to find the money to do this. I think they've got a local match for at least part of it, and I'm sure that's a conversation they'll be having in earnest after this flood dies down.
Well, and Frank, just meanwhile, what's it like there? I mean, I can't imagine kids are getting on buses and going to schools, or people are separating from their families and going to work. I mean, Is everybody just bailing? What's going on?
Well, you know, I mean, it really depends. You know, like where I am here in Sand Springs, Oklahoma, pretty hard hit. A lot of businesses are evacuated. However, if you go to the far side of the highway out of this bowl, it's not exactly business as usual, but their business is going on and mm-hmm. life is going on pretty much normally. Downtown Tulsa is, you know, it's raining like crazy and it's wet. People are running around in the rain and water gushing, but it's not flooding. Mm-hmm. And so it really varies quite a bit depending on how close you are to the river.
And hopefully the waters recede, hopefully the rain ends, and then what?
Well, then, you know, depends really on how bad the flood gets, because, you know, it could get much worse than it is now, and if that happens, then there's going to be an enormous cleanup, enormous rebuilding. As it is, there's going to be quite a bit of that. You're going to have mosquitoes, you're going to have a lot of problems, and you're going to be looking at rebuilding these levees.
Yeah. NPR's Frank Morris, sitting on a levee on the Arkansas River, which runs through Tulsa, Oklahoma there, in the pouring rain. Frank, thank you so much.
In a car.
Oh, good. Better. Thank you.
All right. Okay, you bet. Bye.
Well, tonight, anchors from the Fox Business Network and China's state TV will debate the U.S.-China trade war. Trish Regan on Fox Business, who sees China's trade practices as unfair, is hosting the debate on her show with Liu Xin from China Global Television Network. Regan played some tape of Liu Xin on her show last week.
A state media news presenter named Liu Xin launched a personal attack on me. Watch.
She's so sure of U.S. victimhood, so indignant, that her eyes practically spit fire. If you were an American who didn't know any better, you too might clench your fists and pound the wall.
Wow. My eyes? They spit fire? My fists? Oh, dear. Not quite. But you know what? I'm going to take it as a compliment. She says I'm emotional. Yeah, I get a little emotional. I'm proud to show my emotion when I'm confronted with a reality that will be bad for Americans.
So again, those two will debate each other tonight. The broadcast has been highly anticipated on social media in China. And joining us now is Bill Bishop, who authors the Sinocism newsletter, which offers analysis and commentary on China. He's in Washington. Bill, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me.
So what do we know about this debate, first of all?
So it's interesting. Now it looks like it will not be a live debate. The Chinese side has said that there were, after the foreign ministry said it was happening, now CGTN has come out and said that there are issues, problems with rights, and so they will not, copyright issues, so they will not be able to broadcast it live. And I guess instead, Liu Xin, the CGTN anchor, will be calling into the show.
Mm-hmm. Interesting they're talking about it being about rights, because some may look at that and say maybe the Chinese don't want to broadcast this live because they wouldn't have the ability to censor it.
Oh, I think that certainly would be a risk. If I were the responsible cadre in Beijing, I would probably be very happy this will no longer be live, because there are all sorts of downside risks to the wrong things being said and broadcast, especially where we are today, what's 5 or 6 days before the 30th anniversary of June 4. So things are very sensitive and the censors are working in overdrive.
June 4 being Tiananmen Square in right. China and the massacre there. But there's a lot of excitement in China about the idea of these two news anchors debating each other.
Sure, seems like that on Chinese social media. I mean, what's interesting, I think, as Liu Xin pointed out, you know, she criticized Trish Regan for talking about, I guess, the U.S. being a victim. You know, one of the things we're seeing in the official PRC propaganda messaging is basically the key theme is that China is the innocent victim of American bullying and hegemony in furtherance of America's plot to thwart China's rise. And so this sort of feeds into that idea that no, America is not the victim. We, China, are the victim, and you need to stop bullying us, which is the very, very repetitive message in Chinese propaganda right now.
What does this TV debate and all the talk around it, though, say to you about the current state of the trade war with China? It seems like it's really ratcheted up over the last couple of weeks.
It's very hard to see any near-term positive outcome. I think what everyone is pinning their hopes on, who wants the downward trajectory to be arrested, is that President Trump and General Secretary Xi will meet at the G20, I think the 25th or 26th of June in Japan, and that somehow out of that meeting will come at least an agreement to stop the decline and figure out ways to resume dialogue to get the relationship on a healthier into a healthier space. But I think what you're seeing is we're on all these forces on both sides are being unleashed, and it's going to be very hard, if not actually impossible, to put those back in the bottle. And so I think it's, again, as I said earlier, it's extremely difficult to have a positive, a constructive near-term view on the U.S.-China relationship. And frankly, I am in the camp that we are very much in a new era of U.S.-China relations, that we are now into this phase, this era where it is going to be a much more competition, friction, conflict-filled, fraught relationship.
Does that extend to military?
Let's hope not. I think that's the last recourse. I don't think either side wants that, but I think, you know, there are ways to have that kind of a much more friction-filled relationship without having any sort of direct military contact. Certainly, the U.S. and the Soviet Union figured out how to do that for a number of decades. But, you know, this is obviously a different kind of relationship than that. But at the same time, you know, you're seeing, again, I think what we in the U.S. have officially changed our view towards China. You're seeing now on the Chinese side too as well. I think the way they're ratcheting up the propaganda, it's really a, you know, they are telling the population and the world, you know, that our relationship with the U.S. has changed. And, you know, they're coming out and, you know, it's the U.S. is trying to keep us down. We are China, you know, we're powerful now. We've stood up. We no longer will accept foreign bullying. And so, you know, it's and this goes, I think, also back to this potential debate between the Fox News anchor and the CGTN anchor, because it's also all about China standing up, China having a greater voice in sort of international discourse, international media, and being able to say it with someone who's, you know, has extremely good English, is very articulate, and, you know, is clearly from this, you know, sort of ongoing debate, which is Reagan, is becoming even more of a star in China.
That's Bill Bishop, who authors the Sinicism newsletter. Bill, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And as we watch the effects of the trade war here in the United States, another bad start to trading today. The Dow Jones Industrial falling again. It's been falling for the last couple of weeks. We'll continue to monitor that and all the aspects of the U.S.-China trade war here and now.
Here and Now and the following message is supported by Daily Harvest. Daily Harvest delivers carefully sourced, chef-crafted smoothies, soups, harvest bowls, overnight oats, and more, all built on fruits and vegetables. Each single-serving cup can be prepared in minutes. Daily Harvest is designed for convenience, so you can load up on fruits and vegetables first thing in the morning, before bed, and anytime in between. Learn more about Daily Harvest and get 3 free cups in your first box at dailyharvest.com/now.
It's 1965. A white minister is murdered in Selma, Alabama, but no one is held to account.
More than 50 years later, we return to the place where it happened to call a lie, and finally solve this murder.
White Lies from NPR. New episodes drop Tuesdays.
Let's get back to our top story. Special Counsel Robert Mueller making his first public remarks today since the beginning of his investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election. Speaking at the Justice Department, Mueller explained why his report didn't offer a conclusion on whether President Trump obstructed justice.
If we had had confidence that the president clearly did not commit a crime, we would have said so. We did not, however, make a determination as to whether the president did commit a crime. The introduction to the Volume 2 of our report explains that decision. It explains that under long-standing department policy, a president cannot be charged with a federal crime while he is in office. That is unconstitutional.
Joining us now for more is former prosecutor Paul Butler, professor of law at Georgetown University. Paul, welcome to Here and Now.
Hey, Jeremy, it's great to be here.
And what do you make of what Mueller had to say today, that the reason that he didn't make a determination on whether Trump obstructed justice was because of this policy that says you can't indict a sitting president?
I think a fair interpretation of what Mueller said about charging Trump with obstruction is, I didn't do it because I couldn't do it. Mueller made the suggestive comments that it's the responsibility of Congress to address alleged criminality by the president, and that the president can be prosecuted in criminal court after he leaves office. Mueller said he gathered evidence of obstruction to preserve it for future prosecutors after Trump leaves office.
Do you think that Congress is going to take him up on that, if you will, and say, okay, fine, we're going to start impeachment proceedings?
I think it's a difficult decision. It makes leader or Speaker of the House Pelosi perhaps the most important and powerful person in the United States at this moment. I think her calculus is that she probably is persuaded by those 10 episodes of obstruction that are contained in the Mueller report that the president committed the high crimes and misdemeanors that are required for impeachment. But if her ultimate goal is to have Trump removed from office, she may believe that impeachment would actually hinder that goal because of the politics, and it might be the best decision to let the electoral process proceed.
It was pretty clear in Mueller's statement today that the reason that he did what he did in the report and didn't make a determination was because of that longstanding Justice Department policy that says you can't indict a sitting president. We went back and looked at what the Attorney General William Barr said in his press conference in April, and he said that he asked Mueller if that was the reason, and Mueller was pretty clear that that wasn't the reason. What do you make? Was Barr misleading the American people?
You know, today Mueller said he didn't question Barr's good faith in releasing the full report. I think those words were chosen very carefully because we know that Mueller wrote a letter objecting to the way that Barr had initially characterized the report. So I think that there are important questions remaining about whether Barr was fully transparent with regard to what the Mueller report actually contained. At the same time, Mueller wrote his report to the Attorney General, and it was Barr's decision whether and how much it would be released to the public. Mm-hmm. And Mueller doesn't seem to have concerns that important parts of the report were redacted.
That's Paul Butler, professor of law at Georgetown University, on today's Top Story. Thank you so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
And we want to catch up now with Doug Glanville, the former Cubs player, UPenn engineering grad, lecturer at both UPenn and Yale, and as you may know, NBC Sports Chicago commentator who was racially taunted live on camera while broadcasting from Wrigley Field during a Cubs game. Well, he was, wasn't he? That's the headline of the op-ed he wrote for the New York Times. I was racially taunted on television, wasn't I? Because people debated whether the fan making an upside-down OK sign near Doug's face meant it as the white supremacist symbol it is, or was playing some silly circle game. There's a picture at herenow.org, but the Cubs decided it was racist. They banned that fan from the park. Doug Glanville joins us now. Doug, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So take us through what happened. You were giving your commentary at a Cubs game, the same field where you started your baseball career. Did you notice this fan?
I did not, certainly not at the time. Yeah. I was, you know, just doing what we do, a live hit, and yeah. I'm in the dugout. I'll come out for a specific inning, and the camera, what we call high first, will shoot down all the way across the field to zoom in tight on me. This person was somewhat behind me. He wasn't directly behind me, but I had no idea. And right. It wasn't until later when I was kind of going through my Twitter feed that I saw all this ruckus. Realized there was a lot more going on.
Yeah, your Twitter feed is exploding. You had people debating what had happened. It was the same sign flashed by the New Zealand mosque shooter at his trial. So what were people saying?
Well, I mean, it was a firestorm of debate. And certainly right out of the gate, there was this, well, is this a circle game? a lot of kids play, even in the minor leagues, I was familiar with it.
It's like you use this hand sign down, you know, below your waist to try to get people to look.
Right. And then there's, of course, the other conversation, which was threading around the white supremacists and the New Zealand shooter, trying to figure out and unpack what actually the intent of the fan, all these things. So you started to see all this speculation also flow through. I had a lot of phone calls from, you know, my parent company, NBC Sports Chicago, and also the Cubs, Chicago Cubs.
Well, we should be very clear. The Cubs investigated the incident, took it very seriously, and they determined that the man was, in fact, making a racist gesture. They banned him from the field. So they're not at all confused about this. But talk about this conversation that starts that you are painfully aware of as an African-American in America, of people saying, oh, you're just reading into this.
Yeah, and I want to underscore what you just said about how this investigation sort of played. The Cubs did on their own, even before I even got back to the hotel, had already kind of gotten into figuring out what they believed to be the intent. They felt it was more than likely that this was some sort of racially charged white supremacy sign. And what I tried to unpack was the idea of ambiguity. Racism and experiencing racism as an African-American in the United States often comes through this lens of ambiguity. In fact, sometimes it's for the purpose, express purpose to mask intent, but it's also the sort of fine line and sort of nuance that sometimes comes with moments that you experience that you attribute to race or identity. The cab came by and didn't pick you up. This has happened to me a number of times. Well, this has happened enough in a pattern that you start to connect the dots. There can be something as dramatic as, you know, someone, you know, burning a cross on your lawn, which thankfully has not happened to me. But, you know, some of the things that are a little bit more subtle, whether it's prejudicial or biased, which did happen to me, a police officer asking me if I'm shoveling to make money when I was actually standing in my own driveway shoveling. Mm. So this ambiguity is so painful because it forces you at times to question your own sort of lens by which you're looking at it. And you try to rule out things, hoping that it's something else, as opposed to this labeling, as you say, race baiting, you're playing the race card as if that's your first card in your deck. But when you have a pattern throughout so many different parts of your life, whether it's trying to buy a home, trying to get your kids to the school, you know, walking to the store, whatever it may be, you have enough information to sort of be able to extrapolate at different times the undercurrent of your experience. And I think that ambiguity can be very torturous.
Well, as you write, ambiguity is a friend to racism. And white supremacists know this. I mean, you remind us that some people think that this sign itself, this OK sign as a white supremacist symbol, came up as a prank to get the media to overreact to innocuous gestures. In other words, hey, let's make believe this sign is something and then everybody will overreact. And it'll add to that sense that you've just described of people like you being questioned, like, oh, why are you looking for racism in that? And then the sign actually became a genuine expression of white supremacy. But again, it's still ambiguous enough that you have to not only have that racist gesture on television, but you have to deal with people saying, oh, why are you seeing it that way?
Right. Well, and the key word is taunting, because there is a taunting that you can possibly even flirt and play with this idea, the psychological warfare around racism. Right. You know, so, no, I don't have to blatantly call you the N-word to create all these sort of ripple effects that emotionally, psychologically play into your experience as an African-American in this country.
Right. Which is why you say that it really kind of doesn't even matter what the fan intended. And you write another great example. You give the example of somebody who may love rodeos, and they're in the same office as you, and they hang a lasso, a lariat, a rope with a loop at their desk. Well, that's, you know, an intention to honor cowboys. He loves rodeos. But you also have the right, as an African-American, to be offended by that because you see a noose. But what, that doesn't mean that he's racist.
Right, and these two worlds can collide. And I tried to step back to take in that many symbols we have may have began in innocuous formats.
And you may be offended, and maybe you can both have a conversation about that, and he can say, oh, I'm sorry, you know, this is about rodeos, and I'm sorry that triggered you, and you can say, yeah, it's just the symbol. But it could also be somebody purposely putting that out there and lying.
Well, we saw this in the news throughout, I guess it was at the plants, right? GMC, I think, went through it, was General Motors. Some people were, you know, vehemently denying, you know, and so yeah, there was clearly like, why are you hanging a noose in a car factory or what? And I think the real pernicious, sometimes poisonous aspect is when someone is aware of that duality and still wants to kind of throw it out there and flirt it out there to create this tension. And the irony of the circle game, by the way, this idea that you make the symbol and make someone look, it is actually fitting because you're. Often with these type of experience with racism and the nuance of racism, you are trying to make someone look somewhere else to take away or change the reality that still exists and that are often woven in sometimes institutionally into our country.
Well, you say we have to acknowledge racism takes place not only with fire hoses, but with whispers and hand signs. But I just have to ask you, Doug Glanville, again, NBC Sports Chicago commentator, what's happened since? I mean, that's a vulnerable position always. To be broadcasting live in a huge crowd. Are you now maybe a little more feeling vulnerable?
Well, the day after was tough because we had a lot of discussions about security details and safety became a different part of my job. I would say also I'd be remiss in not recognizing the amazing support from the fans that expressed outrage or... I remember leaving the next night, and when I walked through the crowd, as I usually do in the sixth inning when I'm headed back to the studio, I had sections of fans standing up and clapping or waving or just sort of acknowledging. And that was important. There are so many allies that understand and want it to be different. And that appreciation is, you know, how I came in. My experience growing up in Teaneck, New Jersey, was very positive in how I saw an inclusive community. It's been tough just to kind of navigate the aftermath. My Twitter feed, you know, I work with a PR person. You know, she's been blocking a lot of people on Twitter. So, you know, because there's a lot of people flashing okay signs and really upset also at the Cubs' reaction because they thought, oh, well, we're going to ban everybody. We've got to ban every symbol. And so, I think some of that's being directed towards me as if it was judge, jury, and executioner, when actually I was calling for due process. I was calling for just open dialogue and discussion.
Well, we wish you the best there. And you've got a thought-provoking op-ed that we will link people to at hereandnow.org. Doug Glanville, thank you so much.
Thank you for your time. Appreciate you having me on.
It is college graduation season, which means some of the 20 million or so people attending American colleges and universities are celebrating years of work. Some of them are the first in their family to attend college, like Maria Zavala, who's about to graduate from the University of California, Santa Barbara. Oh, and by the way, she's also a DACA recipient. Maria joins us now. Thanks for joining us and congratulations.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to be here.
Well, and how does it feel to be the first in your family to graduate college?
I mean, I really can't describe how I feel. I feel like I have gone through so much during this entire process, starting with what college to select, whether it was financially feasible to be able to attend college. It was quite a rough road, but I'm glad that I was able to make it through, and I'm just really excited for what's next.
And you're not just a first-generation college student. You're also a DACA recipient. You and your family came to the U.S. Illegally from Honduras when you were young. Tell me about that part of your story.
Yeah. So, I mean, we came to the U.S. in 2002. So I had to repeat first grade because I hadn't learned English just yet. I did very well during elementary school. I graduated with honors in high school, 4.0 student. I honestly was not sure whether I could go to college or not. At the time, there wasn't any DACA. There wasn't any California Dream application, so I couldn't apply for financial aid. Fortunately, though, in 2013 is when the California Dream application came about, and I was able to apply for financial aid. And so that just made it many other things possible for me.
But while you've been in school, of course, there's been a big debate about what to do about all of the DACA recipients in this country.
Yeah.
did you think to yourself, I'm going to have to leave the United States when I'm done, or I'm not sure I'll be able to stay?
That was a conversation I had to have with myself, because when Trump had announced that the DACA program was going to end, I really wasn't sure what it was that I needed to do. I decided to stay, though. I work as a student. Most of us, the DACA recipients, do work. We just really prayed for something good to come out of this. And I mean, luckily, we still have DACA, and I'm still able to work. And actually, I work full time while going to school full time currently.
Wow.
Yeah, so I'm just waiting until I graduate to be able to just work full time and not have to worry about school as well. But whether I'll be able to continue to work through DACA years from now, I really don't know. But having a savings account is definitely very important to me. So that's what I'm doing right now, saving money, hoping for the best, but honestly expecting the worst, unfortunately.
Did your college classmates, your peers, did they know about your status?
So some of them did. I did receive some text messages of you'll be fine. But being that they are citizens, I just don't think that they understood what was at stake here, where I basically support myself. I have been supporting myself since high school. My mom has always been like a emotional support, but financially, most DACA recipients, their parents are very low income. And so it's really hard to support an entire family. And so having to go back to a country where I haven't been since I was like 3 years old, the turmoil that's happening in Honduras right now, all the uncertainties, that was very scary, which I don't think my friends really understood or grasped.
So as you prepare to graduate, how much debt do you have from college?
That's a really good question. So in the state of California, students who apply for the California Dream application are eligible for loans, but they are considered state loans. So we are allowed to take out up to, I think, about $24,000. But luckily, because of financial aid grants and scholarships that I received, in addition to other outside scholarships, I'm only graduating with $15,000 in debt, which is definitely lower than the average.
Okay, so now let me just ask you the question that I would ask any graduate, somebody that hasn't been through the things that you've been through, but any graduate.
Yeah.
What do you want to do once you're all done? What do you want to do with your career?
Yeah, the million-dollar question. Initially, I wanted to go to medical school and then just realize that that is not feasible for me, not in my legal state. I can't borrow loans like any other student can, so medical school would not be possible for me. So then I really thought about why I wanted to go to medical school, and I just reasoned that it's because I really want to help other people, as cheesy as that may sound, but more specifically, other individuals that are stuck in my similar situation. I just got really lucky to be able to be where I am today. For example, I could have easily been one of the children at the border. And the fact that I was able to make it here and be as privileged as I am, I think that's just absolutely crazy. And so I really want to work for private orgs and be able to assist others.
That is Maria Zavala, who is a soon-to-be graduate of UC Santa Barbara. Maria, thanks for joining us and congratulations once again.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.